Welcome back to the program. You know, from our earliest days of preschool and kindergarten, we learn about the importance of sharing. Yet somehow along the way, that sharing is replaced by ownership and consumption. And yet, even through our recent period of hyper-consumption, we still checked books out of the library, we rented videos and used Netflix, and we shopped on eBay. Arguably, all of these things are but forerunners of a whole new collaborative way of looking at our culture. We're going to talk about this today with my guest, Rachel Botsman. She writes, consults, and speaks on the power of collaboration and sharing and how it can transform business and the way we live today. She received her BFA from the University of Oxford. She did postgraduate work at Harvard. She's a former director of the Clinton Foundation and the author of a new book entitled What's Mine is Yours, The Rise of Collaborative Consumption. Rachel Botsman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Jeff.
Explain first what you mean by collaborative consumption.
So the easiest way to understand collaborative consumption is basically technology is actually taking us back to really old market behaviors. So we're swapping and trading and bartering and renting and sharing, but they're being reinvented and updated for the Facebook age.
And certainly, as you indicated, technology is really the key thing that is allowing us to do this on a large scale.
That's right. I mean, you mentioned in your opening that actually a lot of these ideas have been around for years, such as libraries and laundrettes. But what technology does is it makes sharing convenient, it makes it frictionless, and it makes it even fun. So there's a lot of systems, whether it's car sharing or swap trading, that just wouldn't be possible without the internet.
But certainly we're talking about a lot of ways. I mean, car sharing, bike sharing, so many things that we might touch on are things that require a kind of cultural re-education given the times that we've been living in.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, you know, we grow up as kids being taught to share, and we share things like parks and roads and, you know, hotels. Like, hotels don't call their business bed sharing, I guess, for good reasons. But, you know, it's very strange when the stigmas of sharing set in. And for the last 60 or so years, we've been taught to build our own little fiefdoms. And we don't even know the neighbor on the other side of the fence. So I think that's what's so interesting, is that people often don't stop and think that consumerism and, you know, a hyper-individualistic mindset is a very new phenomenon. We were sharing and cooperating for thousands of years.
Can we learn something by looking to see where some of these new ways of sharing, not the traditional ones, but some of these newer ways of sharing, to see where they're taking hold, either in what segments and in what kind of communities?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, often where you're seeing them take off is where there's a problem or where there's distrust. So transportation is a great example. So the car industry are actually saying we need to reinvent our sector. You know, there's all this data coming out that just young people don't see cars as a sign of status. They think of mobility. So that's why, you know, you're seeing bike sharing, fastest growing form of transportation in the world. You're seeing ride sharing, car sharing like Zipcar, but also peer-to-peer car sharing, where people are actually starting to rent out their cars to their neighbors through the likes of relay rides. Then there's other sectors such as social lending, which is basically, you know, you have $100 to lend, and I need to borrow $100, and together we're matched. So like, you know, match.com for banking.
Mm-hmm.
And that grew by 800% last year, and is meant to become 10% of the personal loans market. Now, I think that's because the internet creates the efficiency, but also the trust, you know, the social glue. But it's also the flip side of our distrust in big banks, that we're looking for alternative systems and once again turning to each other.
Talk about the trust, because many of these systems, whether it's everything from the kind of lending you're talking about to zip cars to all of it, do require a certain degree, a certain level of trust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's one of the principles, actually. Like, we call it trust between strangers. And if the mechanics aren't in place to build trust between strangers, most of the systems fail. So for the online communities, that often involves some kind of reputation system. So that doesn't matter if it's, you know, me trying to figure out if this person's safe to share a car ride with, whether I feel comfortable lending out my lawnmower, you name it, trust is the cornerstone. So I think, you know, reputation capital and reputation systems, we're just in the nascent stages, but that's going to become like a credit history.
And this is what companies like eBay and PayPal have been very effective in establishing.
Yeah, I mean, they are the grandfathers of this idea. I mean, what eBay has proven is that the trust that we form face-to-face, you know, whether it was a deal and a handshake or just the way we form relationships, can be mimicked online so that, you know, a positive rating, a power seller rating becomes like a first-hand reference from someone we've never met. So I think what's so funny about eBay is, you know, 98% of trades will receive a positive rating. And I think it's something to do with the fact that it's kind of like an old-fashioned rumor mill meets like the network world. And those two things come together and make people very accountable to one another.
Uh-huh. What are we seeing in terms of sharing within neighborhoods? Because this is another whole arena that is springing up.
Yeah, I mean, that's, for me, one of the most beautiful things about collaborative consumption is it happens on a macro, big corporate level, but then also on a hyper-local level as well, and is very much tied to the resurgence of communities. So you see examples from, you know, tool lending libraries making a big comeback. There's a wonderful example in Santa Rosa near you that's actually transformed a community. Neighborhood sharing schemes, so peer-to-peer rental of goods that we don't use often. You know, it's actually 80% of the stuff in our houses we use less than once a month. So neighbors are actually figuring out that they can share that. To things like the food movement, you know, community gardens, community service agriculture, making a massive comeback.
How much of this is generational? I mean, to a certain extent, you talk to baby boomers about this, and maybe they get it, but they don't internalize it. It does seem to be a generational issue.
It does. It's a really interesting question. I have a little bit of an issue with sort of generalizations around generations.
Uh-huh.
A bit of a mouthful. But the thing is, Gen Y or the millennials, so people under the age of 33, I think is the cutoff, they're growing up sharing files and videos and knowledge and music. And now those behaviors are extending into other areas of their lives. And it's very normal for them to form trust through communities like Facebook. So it's just intuitive to them. So, yes, the uptake is faster with them. And it's also the way they express their identity is very different from my parents' generation, where having two cars and having the big house and the white picket fence was a sign of status and identity. But the interesting thing is when I talk to my grandma about these ideas, the war generation, she inherently gets it, you know, because they depended on each other. Although she gets a bit lost, you know, when I start talking about augmented reality and social networks, but she gets the philosophy, she gets the heart of what I'm talking about.
Because the desire for status is kind of a basic human desire, the question, it seems to me, is what replaces the status symbols of the past? What in this new paradigm become the status talismans?
That is a great question, and it is so core to, and one of the things I'm most passionate about is, my hypothesis is that for years we have expressed ourselves through the things that we owned and the swoosh on our sneakers. And actually, our identity is now forming. We're expressing who we are by the communities that we belong to. So, you know, whether it's the number of followers we have on Twitter or what we share on Facebook. So what we're actually doing is starting to feed our social self and express ourselves through shared experiences and communities. So to make that real, have you heard of Threadless, the T-shirt site Threadless?
No.
So Threadless is basically the largest, I think, online retailer of T-shirts. And everything is designed by the community and crowdsourced. And when you talk to people like, why do you buy T-shirts from Threadless? They say, oh, because the T-shirts are cool. but then they'll go into, you know, how they're part of this really cool community. So they're expressing who they are beyond the product itself. It's much more about the community that they belong to.
When we see these communities forming, talk a little bit about the extent to which there's diversity in them, or are they communities of people that are essentially alike? What are you seeing?
You know, it's the one thing, it blew me away with the range of people and backgrounds, but also motivations. So as we touched on, there's a mixture of ages. This is happening not just in main metro areas. It's all around the world. A mixture of socioeconomic demographics and psychographics, but also, like, people, some people go into this for self-interest. You know, some people go into this because they recognize, whether they're a venture capitalist or an entrepreneur, there's good money to be made. And the other end of the spectrum are people that go into this because of a pure community or sustainability mindset, because it's inherently greener and it inherently has social, positive social consequences.
One of the other things that we're seeing in this that you talk about is that even people that can still afford the stuff today are trying to do less of it so that more resources are available for experience. And that's part of this shifting from consumerism to experience. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many studies coming out, and the papers are just full of stories of people really starting to figure out what makes them happy and fulfilled. And everything is indicating that there's a massive shift between purchasing stuff to investing in shared experiences. And that could be holidays, it could be travel, it could be, you know, joining bowling leagues. But what's interesting is, like, take Zipcar, for example. People often say, like, being a Zipster actually carries a social cachet. You know, they're proud of it. So, yeah, they might do it because it saves money and because they actually have figured out they don't need to own a car, but it's actually, again, it's coming back to the identity question. They're proud of the statement that it makes about them.
What are the broader economic consequences, though, that all of this is going to have in terms of consumerism and the marketplace, given how large a part of our economy has been dependent on consumers?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think the crash has led to a questioning of the health of the consumer system. And we rationally know that this is one big Ponzi scheme, environmentally and economically. So the consequences are our economy is dependent on selling more stuff. And at the heart of collaborative consumption is actually starting to think about usage, you know, eking out as much usage from a product, thinking about a services economy, a relationship economy. There's so many terms floating around. But we, you know, you mentioned Netflix. Blockbuster is in its coffin, and Netflix, I think, was just valued at $145 a share. So the reinvention, it's not saying that consumerism is dead, but I do believe that hyperconsumption is a movable fact of life. It's not something that we have to stick to, and our economy doesn't have to depend on it.
How will fashion and styles be subsumed into this?
Fashion, clothes. I mean, we looked at systems where people are sort of co-creating fashion and styles. I don't know. I mean, I guess you could say a lot of the consignment stores and the return to, the people embracing, I don't even like the word secondhand, antique or vintage, is part of this groundswell. And I think retail models are going to fundamentally change, you know, that clothes swapping and even shoe swapping. And the one area we did really explore is I think there's going to be a massive repair culture. So you're starting to see things like denim therapy pop up where people say, I love my jeans. I don't want to throw them away. I'm going to buy one really good pair and I'm going to keep them for the next 10 years. So I think with fashion, you're going to start to see luxury be redefined in a way that people invest in fewer pieces and keep them for life.
Uh-huh. In terms of peer-to-peer sharing, one of the things that you talk about is some of the things that we're seeing in the travel world. That's fascinating. Mm-hmm. Talk about that.
Yes, yeah, so the book actually opens with the story of Airbnb. And Airbnb is essentially a matchmaking service for locals who want to rent out their space and visitors looking for unique accommodations with the added benefit of a local experience. And what's so fascinating about it is when the guys founded Airbnb, they just assumed that it would be spare rooms that people would rent. But everything from, you know, castles in Scotland to chateaus in France to these incredible villas in Italy are being rented out peer-to-peer. And I think what people are realizing is it doesn't matter if they have a couch or a spare room or a castle, they're all underutilized assets that they could actually rent out and meet new people through.
What are we seeing in terms of how, something you touched on a few moments ago, how it is dramatically changing the retail landscape?
Yeah, I mean, with the latest retail report just came out, I think we're 5% down, and that actually shopping rates are lower than they were 10 years ago. So I think it's very interesting. I'm starting to look into the future of retail. I think shared experiences, again, are going to be a huge part of retail. I mean, Apple I have very mixed feelings around because, you know, they've got this weird halo around them where they're actually a poster child of obsolescence. But I think one of the reasons why people love Apple is you go into those retail stores and it's actually about far more than the product, you know, from the Genius Bar to the lectures. It feels like Apple are enhancing your life beyond the iPod or beyond the laptop. So I think retail experiences are going to have a very strong community component into them, built into them. Like I just read Adidas across Asia are building showering facilities because cycling is making such a big comeback. So that's actually a very powerful indicator that they're saying people will come into our store for a service versus buying Adidas product.
Uh-huh. And in fact, one of the things that we're seeing, I mean, the Apple story is a good example, is that retail has to become more of an experience as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it absolutely, absolutely. And not just bricks and mortar. I mean, if you look at Nike is another great example. Nike are actually spending 50% less on traditional product advertising. And instead, they're investing in things like Nike Plus, which is the world's largest online running community, where people share tips and nutrition advice and songs and running routes and arrange to meet up in the real world. So again, that's Nike saying community is a huge part of our brand now, not just the retail store as we knew it.
How global are these trends?
Massively global. I mean, it's really interesting. In different parts of the world, you see different things taking off at a different rate. So, for example, in the UK, social lending that I mentioned, staggering growth because the fall of the banks was so hard. Asia, you're seeing the rise of a lot of bike sharing and innovative forms of taxi sharing apps because congestion is such a big problem. So I think what's happening is there's different flavors and forms of it depending on the problems that are acute to that particular country.
And what about in the U.S.? I mean, do you see the adaptation taking place quickly?
Yeah, I mean, there's in terms of the companies, there are hotbeds of, you know, a lot of the companies are coming out of Boston, New York, and Silicon Valley. You know, a lot of these are becoming the new darlings of the venture capital world. And then, as we mentioned, a lot is actually happening in the Midwest and in the South, where on the local level, where there's strong communities. I would love to see the big corporates, the Fortune 500, really embrace this idea, and I think they're missing an opportunity. I mean, I think we're just starting to get on their radar, but it's crazy that, like, you know, Bank of America or Citibank aren't thinking about having a peer-to-peer lending arm when it's such a huge sector.
How can some of the big corporations embrace this and not feel threatened by it, in your view?
I think, you know, some of them have to embrace it. I mean, I hate to bang on about cars, but Bill Ford, you know, said, we're no longer in the business of cars. We have to be in the business of mobility. And you are seeing, like, Daimler and Peugeot just launched car sharing and ride sharing programs. I think what they've got to do is it's a huge cultural change for them. So I think they need sort of innovation incubators that aren't stuck in the old mindset and have real freedom to experiment, but to see these ideas as the next source of innovation for their company. And then the flip side of that, the big, if I was in telco or technology communications, I would be massively excited because they're the enablers of these systems.
Uh-huh. Rachel Botsman, her book is What's Mine is Yours, The Rise of Collaborative Consumption. It is just out from Harper's. Rachel, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thanks so much, Jeff.
Thank you.